Say, I want to cover three more things in the course. The three more things I want to cover are Grover's algorithm that we're going to see now, quantum search algorithm. I want to cover quantum cryptography, at least introduction to. And I want to cover a protocol of relativistic quantum information called quantum energy teleportation. So for quantum energy teleportation will be tomorrow, and today we're going to see Grover, and we're going to see introduction to quantum cryptography. That's why I'm going to project first the notes for Grover and then little presentation about cryptography. You will have full notes about everything there. Okay. So Grover's algorithm. Grover's algorithm is a problem of what we call unstructured search, which is I give you a list that is not ordered, and I want you to find me one element. For example, I give you the phone book, which is an ordered list, right? But I don't want you to find me a number. I give you a number, find me a person. It's not ordered by numbers. Agreed? So if I ask you to find me the name of a person given a number in a phone book, you're gonna have a hard time. You're gonna have to go one by one until you find the right one. Make sense? Everybody? So here we have eight items. So think of them, these are the names of the people. And think that each entry here would be tensor with the information that you want to obtain, okay? So these are just the entries. So for simplicity, I don't add the tensor. These are the entries, right? The containers, the boxes that contain the information. And if this is the name of a person, tensor with it would be the phone number. The opposite, right? Well, again, whatever. If this is the, if you're looking for a name given a number, let's say these are the numbers, and they're tensored with the name of the person. Make sense? So for simplicity, I'm not going to add the tensor with the information that you're storing in each box if you want, and we're going to just focus on the registers. Okay, but it should be understood. We're not looking for those numbers. We're looking to whatever's attached to those numbers. Make sense? All right. In fact, we know the numbers. That's the input. All right, so for example, I'm going to do an example. We're going to do it in general, of course, but it's much easier to see in a concrete example. Let's say an example with eight items, right? Which are the numbers, the entries from 0 to 7 here. And we're going to be searching for the entry number 5, okay? We don't know the number that goes with it, but we know it's the register number 5. Make sense? All right. So what's this algorithm? So first of all, we need to prepare the phone book. And what is a phone book, though? What is an unstructured search? Well, you have to prepare me a state that the probability that if I random pick one and I measure one, right, I measure one instance randomly, I'm going to get a homogeneous probability. The probability is 1 over the number of items, right? I want a list that is homogeneously distributed, the probability of finding one at random, if I look at random. So in this particular case, we prepare it as a superposition of all the possible entries, okay? That's what the tensor of the Hadamard does. Remember what the Hadamard does? It creates homogeneous superpositions. So we have, we apply the Hadamard to the 0 in the computational basis, and we get a uniform superposition of all the entries. So this is 000 plus 001 plus 010 plus 011, etc. 1 over root of 8 in this case. Make sense? Well, yes. Make sense, everybody? All right. So that is the first step. Instead of having a classical phone book, we have prepared a quantum phone book, which is a uniform superposition of all the things that we want to search. Make sense? All right. That's what the printers of the phone book do. Now, we're going to create a unitary that we call the oracle. So what is the oracle? Well, the oracle is going to be an operator, right? That what it does when I act on the state is going to paint, as I said here, the wanted item. So we want to distinguish the item that we want by assigning a face. Keep in mind that's not a measurement that gives us no information. The oracle acts on the state independent of what the state is. It's an operation that whenever it finds the right item that you're looking for, it will paint it. So something like this. So pick a number. Okay, and change to negative, right, the face, invert the face, of the entry that you're looking for. If we do that to the phone book, we haven't improved anything. Remember, the probability of finding the state is exactly the same. We haven't really done anything that distinguishes the case we're looking for from another, right? It's just painting it, giving it a different face. Make sense? So far, so good. Okay. Let's see. It's a tough one because my jacket is a bit thicker today. All right. Yeah. Does that work?
I think so. We'll find out.
All right. So in our particular example, this is what it looks like, right? It does nothing except for the element that you're looking for, which in this case is 101, right? The number we're looking for. So it changes the face of that one, inverts the face of that one. Make sense? All right. Now the interesting stuff happens now. Amplitude amplification. Now we want to play now with the probabilities of finding the right item when we measure versus the probabilities of finding the wrong items when we measure. So the probability of finding the item that you want, right, is, of course, the inner product of the superposition that you have times the thing that you're looking for, right? Inner product modulus squared. That's the probability of finding. And it's, of course, 1 over n. It's the same as in the classical case with the phone book. If you pick one at random, probability is 1 over n to find it. Make sense? So what we're going to do first is we're going to move to a two-dimensional space, right? We have a vector, which is the superposition of all the possibilities, and we have a vector W, which is the one that we are looking for, right? So we have a two-dimensional space in a way, right? Because it's two vectors in a way, a vector that the Hilbert space is higher dimensional than that, but there is a plane that contains the vector that the superposition and the vector that I'm looking for. Make sense? So what I'm going to find is an orthonormal basis in that plane. I'm going to focus on that plane. So I'm building this S prime, and this S prime is just nothing but Grant Smith, the orthonormalization, right, of these two vectors, W and S, right? So I get S, and I subtract the projection of S on V on W, and then I renormalize S prime. Now I have two vectors that are normalized and are orthogonal, W and S prime. Make sense? For my basis, and this is very nicely geometrically represented like this, right? This is the superposition. This is the phone book, no information if you want, uniform superposition of all the entries. W is what we're looking for, the entry that contains what we're looking for, and S prime is just an orthonormalization of these two. Make sense? Okay. So of course, we can determine I don't see my, there we go. Of course, we take a little look at what the sign, I call that, of course, geometrically, you can see that, of course, S prime is cosine of S prime, S is cosine of S prime plus sine of theta W, where theta is the angle that S has with S prime, right? That's very easy to see geometrically. Now, this cosine of theta and sine of theta can be easily determined because all that we need is to find out the projection of S on S prime, and the projection of S on S prime is literally cosine theta. So by computing the projection of S, the inner product of S and S prime, which is root of 1 minus 1 over n, I get that the sine of theta is actually root of 1 over n. Make sense, everybody? Very easy, because we know, remember, this is like very easy math. I mean, it's done in here, but it's very easy because we know what S is, we know what S prime is. Okay, so it's very easy to actually compute this. Again, the microphone today is not as easy as usual. All right, does that work?
Perfect.
All right, awesome. All right, so Certainly, we can write s as a function of SSN s prime by knowing that sine of theta is 1 over root of n, and cosine of theta will satisfy the trigonometric identity cosine squared plus sine squared equals 1. So far, so good. Any questions? All right. So look what we're going to do. We're going to do two things, right? We start, so let's go back to the beginning of the protocol. We apply the oracle. Remember, the oracle paints the entry that we're looking for. And then we perform a reflection about S, about the S, the axis, if you want, that is given by S. So this is literally a reflection operator, right? Projection twice minus the identity. That's what it does, is a reflection. So geometrically, very easily to see. Oops, sorry. What the reflection is going to do, right, is a reflection of the state with respect to, okay, maybe I'll have it here. So you have to paint. It's something like that, right? First of all, when you do I'm gonna go to the math, but let's focus on the geometry because it's super simple. We have S to begin with. Agreed? First thing that we do is we switch the sign of the W component in S. But that means that you go from S to S, but with a minus sign in the W component. I just change the sign of the W component. So I'm on the other side of the S prime axis. Agreed? And the next thing I do, now I do a reflection with respect to the S axis. So if I do a reflection, this is an angle to theta, right? So this would be an angle to theta as well. It's a reflection. Agreed? So basically, this gets reflected to theta. That way, so the angle with the S prime axis is 3 theta now. Instead of being the original theta, now it's 3 theta. Make sense? Is the geometry of this understood? Because the math is just the arithmetics that support this geometric reasoning, which is very simple. That's what we want to do. Now, look how nice this is. We start far from W, but after doing these two steps, we've gotten closer to W. Agreed? We've increased in the angle theta. The moment the angle theta hits 2 pi, we're on W. So that step has gotten us closer to W, has increased the probability now that if we measure the state that results of this process, we find W. It's a bit higher than before. We're closest to the W axis. Does that make sense? I'm going to show you the math now, but this is the protocol, really. The protocol is very geometrically simple. In the plane that contains what you're looking for and what you start with, right, we're doing operations that get us closer and closer to the W axis. Yeah?
Question. So we're looking for whatever is like linked to W, right?
Yeah.
So wouldn't painting it, wouldn't that imply that we know something?
No. That's the same as, for example, that's the same question as if you ask, wouldn't knowing the telephone number already tells me the person because they're attached in the phone book, in the classical phone book? Can you imagine this is a search algorithm?
Yeah.
So you want to know to what's attached to it. For that, you need to find it in the list.
Yes.
You know what it is. So don't confuse you know what it is to you know where it is. You know what it is, but you don't know where it is in the list. When you want to measure it to see what's attached to it, you know W, but you don't know what's attached to it. You need to find W in order to see what's attached to it. So in order to find W, you need to measure and find W. See what I mean?
No, I see that. It's just that I think maybe this example is misleading me a bit because we labeled the oracle as like U5, so we know that W is in the fifth position, but generally in an unstructured list, we don't know what
No, you don't know it's the fifth position. The sum is commutative. It's not the fifth position. It's the entry that has the number 777-5533. You know the telephone number. W is the telephone number. And the name of the person we're attached to it. Nothing is ordered here. I just pick, it's nice to have it ordered in numbers consecutive to write it as a sum like that instead of having to write 1,000 elements. But it's completely irrelevant what the number is.
So Z operator exists.
You build the operator only with the knowledge of the number of the person, not what you're looking for, with the knowledge of the number of what's attached to it.
And And then here we are only doing manipulations with that, with the number.
Correct.
So how, I don't see how this is bringing us to whatever is attached.
Well, if you have a very high W component,
yeah,
when you measure the phone book, you're going to find the right answer. You're going to do a projection over W very likely. The probability of finding W is high. If the probability of finding W is high, meaning that you're applying a projective measurement, so very close to a projective measurement, that gives you W. Once you project it over that, you have W and what's attached to it. And you've killed everything else. See what I mean? The classical analog, and you should think of the classical analog as it's literally, let's randomly pick a number and see what the name it is next to it. That's what we're doing here. This is very important. It's easy to get. Those are really good questions. It's very easy to not understand what we're doing and thinking that what we're doing is trivial. It's actually very easy. But no, you don't know what's attached to W. You know W. You don't know where W is. It's a quantum superposition. There's no ordering in a quantum superposition of things. You just know W. And the fact that I number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 is just for convenience. They could be whatever else, things that you know, like the number of a telephone number of a person. You just need to know W, nothing else. You don't need to know the others, just W. Make sense? Good, good. This is really good.
Professor?
Yeah.
So when I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, so I have this image. So this oracle is some operation that I'm applying on a, not the black box, but like this unstructured.
The form book, the superposition that you created, yeah. What the factory sends you as the form book.
So the operator doesn't need to know where what it is.
Not at all.
Whenever it sees it, it just does it.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. And it doesn't go sequentially.
Is this quantum or not really?
This is very quantum.
The oracle itself is quantum.
Well, hold on. What's the definition of quantum here? It's quantum in the sense that we have a quantum superposition of eigenstates of something, right?
Yeah, I guess like unitarity itself is like...
Classical, that's simple. Being unitary doesn't mean you're quantum, in the sense that being unitary could just be the Hilbert space representation of a symplectic operation in phase space. So if I only have classical mechanics, and I want to represent my classical mechanics in a Hilbert space, I can. Nothing forbids me from it. In fact, obviously, right? Because you can do classical stuff with quantum mechanics too. So you can certainly have representations of classical dynamical functions in a Hilbert space and so on, right? The question is whether you actually needed it or not. What I would call quantum is, did you actually need to use the Hilbert space representation and go through something called quantization map to do it? Now, to do a protocol like this, you would, because you have superpositions that are non-trivial of eigenstates, right? That's how the quantumness manifests in this case.
Okay.
Question.
It's not a question. I just wanted to add, I've written these oracles, so I can explain a little bit. You take your problem, which is undefined in terms of an answer. You create a superposition of every possible answer, and then your oracle examines in parallel every possible answer, and for those for which it finds the result, it flags those. So your oracle is working on a superposition of all possible answers, and it's flagging those particular answers which are the correct answers. And then you are finding those correct answers. So that is basically why you don't know what W is, but your oracle does. It's because it's doing the clever trick of evaluating everything in parallel.
Now, one thing to be careful about, because this is used a lot, not that you said it, right, but it is used a lot, that you have the quantum parallel thing as that's why it's more powerful. That's not true. If I got a classical computer to do parallel search, still gonna scale with n. So it's not the fact that it's doing it in parallel, as I said, like because it's doing it to the whole, I would say it's doing it to the whole superposition. It's not really looking for an element by checking one and one. It's certainly modifying the superposition. It's playing, it's kind of funny. The oracle doesn't even play with the probability. The oracle plays with the relative phases of the thing that you want to flag things. And after the oracle does, that is the reflection, right? That what is called amplitude amplification is what tampers with the probability distribution. To whatever UW flag that not even UW knows. UW, as you're saying, just kicks things. And kicks things in a way that the face of that element is going to change and the others are not. So it's not really acting on the one you're looking for. It's acting on the whole state, kicking it, so that the face of that is inverted. And it's the amplitude amplification step that actually manipulates. And it's often said, and this is a popular science thing that is often said, that is quantum parallelism thing. Are acting in parallel. This is great what you said. What I'm saying is that let's not buy into that, because of course, if I get a classical parallel algorithm, it will still scale like classical. So it's not the fact that it's parallel that makes it better than the classical algorithm. It's the fact that it's quantum, indeed. But right, really good, thank you. Is that clear? I think it's very important to understand the notion of what we're doing here. Because superficially, it may look trivial as, you already knew the answer. What are you doing? No, not at all. All right. OK, so let me go back to geometry just to remind ourselves what we've done. We start with S, which is the homogeneous superposition, right? And then what we build, we are here a plane. This plane is the plane that is spanned by the original state, the uniform superposition, right? And the state that would be the answer, the state that you're looking for. Agreed? That has attached the information that you're looking for, if you want. And now in here, we created an orthonormal basis with Grant Smith, S prime and W. OK, we have the axis here, that's S. That's the angle theta that S has with S prime, right? And what we did here is two things. First, the oracle. Oracle flips the sign of the W component, so brings us here. And then the amplitude amplification step is a reflection about the S axis. So that reflection gives you, this is 2 theta, another 2 theta here. Total of 3 theta with the original one. Make sense? So now we are closer to W. Sorry, you could overshoot. You have to be careful with that. But in principle, if theta is small, imagine the superposition is huge. You have a huge list. Theta is small, so you start taking steps towards W. Make sense? At least one step we took. All right. Oh, no. OK. Right. So this is the arithmetics of what we said, right, literally. So we do the flipping, right? So the flipping is minus 2 root n because it subtracts the one that already contains and adds another with the other sign, if you want. And then we do the reflection. We apply the reflection operator, and we end up with this, right? And geometrically, very easy to see that what we have is that by construction. Now, of course, I mean, we can think of repeating that step n times now, right? Once we have that state, we can also paint again the one you're looking for with the oracle, and then apply the reflection again, and repeat, and repeat, and repeat. In a way, you are, every time that you go, you get 2 theta closer at every step. Agreed, everybody? So we can repeat that n times, and what we get is things like this. We end up with sine of 2n plus 1 theta, cosine of 2n plus 1 theta. We are getting closer to this as we increase the number of steps. Of course, again, you can overshoot, right? So you better be careful with the argument of that, that doesn't overshoot. But in principle, you're getting closer and closer. Make sense?
So it works better when n is large.
Indeed. And we will see. That's the next thing we'll see. So, well, we're going to do it with a small n. Well, yes, I know. OK, well, it's going to be fun, I think. But certainly it works. Let me put it like this. It works really well when n is large. And of course, the risk of overshooting is much higher the shorter, the smaller n is. That's what you meant, which is correct. Now, of course, this is the circuit, right? So the idea is that this is the preparation of the superposition. They do that at the factory when they send you the phone book. And you have the phone book. And then you do a combination of first the oracle and amplitude amplification. Again, oracle, amplitude amplification many times. And when you are satisfied that you've done it enough times, all that you need to do, because now the probability distribution is completely skewed towards the right answer, because you are projecting towards the right answer, basically, then you just measure. And when you measure, you're basically doing a projective measurement on the right answer, because the probability of getting the right answer is really high. And then you got what you're looking for. Makes sense? We're going to do a Mathematica notebook to show you this in a particular case. Does that make sense, everybody? So that's why I like to say that you get the phone book, you shake it enough times. And after you shake it, you just open it randomly and say, this one. And you got the right one by chance, because you played with the chances. Make sense? So we can look at the scaling, right? And say, OK, what we want is, of course, pi over 2. We don't want to overshoot that. Pi over 2 would be exactly getting to W. So then you can ask, what is the value of n, right? How many times do I have to repeat it in order to get pi over 2? And what you get is very easy to solve, right? What you get is this expression. Now, if n is really large, you can do an expansion on the parameter 1 over n. And what you get is that n scales like pi over 4 square root of n. So you only need to do this step square root of n times, as opposed to the number of times that you need to manipulate the phone book if you were doing a classical search, which scales with n. Make sense? Everybody, with the scaling? So it's a reduction of complexity. It's not huge, because it's n to square root n. So it's not like going from polynomial to logarithmic or something like that, but still it's a reduction. If you have 1 million entries, you only need to do 1,000 queries. So if you had a quantum computer that is as fast as a classical computer in evaluating, right, per step of evaluation, then instead of 1 million, you need to do only 1,000. So it's a factor of 1,000 improvement, which is nice for 1 million entries. And of course, it only gets better and better the larger n is. Does that make sense? Now, the cool thing, the reason why this is a quantum algorithm and it's better than classical, is that certainly we are taking advantage of the fact that we can manipulate the probability distributions without having to go one by one on elements of a list. This oracle just kicks, oracle is trained on kicking things and give them a face if they are the right thing. But you don't need to know you're acting on the right thing because you're not acting on the right thing. You're acting on the superposition of everything. Makes sense, everybody? Yeah.
Does the algorithm become better, worse, or doesn't change with like the dimension of the qubit? Because what would
we dimension of the qubit? Well, I express it in terms of qubits, but you don't have to. Keep in mind, this is 7 elements in a list, right? So increasing the number, you just increase the number of qubits in this picture. So it scales the same way, regardless. Make sense? Let me show you something fun, I hope. OK, so I have here, let me see. I maybe need to make it a bit bigger. Oh, 300 is a lot. Yeah, that's too much. I want to show you plots too. OK, hopefully you see that, no? So what I'm doing here is we're going to do an example with 3 qubits, right? Like the one that we've been doing here in the example, the concrete example. So first of all, I prepare the initial state as the computational zero, right? And then I prepare the uniform superposition. That is directly applying the Hadamard tensor 3 times. Make sense? So let's apply it. There you go. That's the initial state, right? The computational zero. And now I want the uniform superposition. So 3 Hadamards. And that gives me the 1 over root 8 every element. Make sense? Uniform superposition. Very nice. Now, the oracle. Let's say that the oracle is going to be the one that we're looking for is this element. OK? That's the element we're looking for. Agreed? In this case, it's 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's actually 6 instead of 5. It would have been nicer if I had picked 5, but I haven't. I'm sorry. All right, nice. So is this one. And then we build the oracle, which is directly is, get the identity and subtract twice the projector over the winner state, the one you're looking for, because that is literally inverting the sign of that component. Yep.
That's actually the negative of what you earlier said, because earlier it was 2s minus I.
No, that is for the reflection, not for the oracle.
Oh, is this the oracle?
This, look, oracle. Yeah, this is the oracle.
Oh.
This, all that I'm doing is that, look at the matrix that results. It just changes the sign of the component of the right one.
OK, sorry, my error.
That's all right. No, it's all right. Looks similar-ish, yeah. Makes sense, everybody? So that's the oracle. It's painting the component of the winner with a minus sign. All right. Nice. So let's apply the oracle. And we end up with that, of course. That's what it does. It just changes the sign of the thing we're looking for. Agreed? Keep in mind, we don't know anything. If we were to measure randomly, nothing is painting and showing a red color. That's the thing, you know. No, this thing has the same probability still of finding anything. Make sense? We haven't gotten any closer. All right, this is the oracle, though. The oracle. The amplitude amplification. I don't know why it's called diffuser here. The amplitude amplification state. Which, as you see, is very different from the oracle. This is exactly what it does. This is the reflection about the s-axis. Make sense? Is the s-vector times is adjoint, right? So twice the projector over the S vector minus the eta nidi. All right, so now I code here steps of Grover, which is take the oracle, then the amplitude amplification, and apply it n times to S. And then I want to see what happened at each time we apply it. So let's say I equals 1. I equals 0, maybe. Yeah. If we do 0 steps, this is just the probability of finding each of the entries, right? So it's uniform. Agreed? Let's see what happens when I apply it once. If I apply it once, oh, look at that. The probability suddenly, that phone book, the probability of randomly finding the right answer is much higher than the rest. Agreed? Now let's apply it twice. Look at that. We landed it. So indeed, we applied twice the steps, and now we know for the phone book, I mean, not quite the right thing, but what is it doing? I don't know. I cannot even see what's going on here. But yeah, those are the probabilities. It's 11 over 8 square root 2 versus 1 over 8 square root 2. The probability of finding the right one is much higher than everything else. Of course, if we apply another step, we're going to overshoot. And we get worse because we overshoot, right? But of course, the problem is that, yeah, there's only like 7 elements or 8 elements, right? These things get much better when the number of elements grow, all right? So maybe for 7 elements is not the best, as we will say. But you can tell, right, how you go from uniform probability distribution, and as I apply the Grover algorithm many times, right, I'm amplifying the probability of finding the right answer. Now, we can also find here the value of the optimal. See, I have here I said 4 qubits, but for 4 qubits, it should be 2 to the 4. So it tells us how many, in fact, let's do the plot first, right? So for 4 qubits, the optimal number is between 2 and 3. You see it here. For 10 qubits, the optimal number is 25, around 25. Make sense? We can actually plot what is the optimal number as a function of the number of qubits. What is this doing? Yeah, I did 10, and for 10, this is not really plotting what I'm thinking is plotting. Oh yeah, no, it's because it's not the number of qubits. This is the number of entries. My bad, it's not, 2 to the x would be the number of qubits, x is the number of entries. So if you have, say, 400, you see that it works, it grows like that, okay? Now, of course, it's going to look like a square root because it's what it is, what it becomes when x is large. Now, interesting things to observe, right? We can actually ask, how many entries do we need in order to nail it with one step? And we can also ask, how many entries do we need in order to nail it with 3 steps? Because with one step, it's got a direct answer, it's 4. And with 3 steps, very approximately 20. And again, in one step, if it's 4, you have 4 elements, Grover gives you the right one, applying it once with a probability 1. So why is this? Well, this is for something fun. I'm going to talk about something that is less science. It is science, it's falsifiable, but it's kind of a wild thing. The number, so if you have a problem where you need to search from, you know, you have many, many things to choose from, many items, right? But only 4 varieties of them, and you need to pick one. People would tell you, well, use Grover. You're going to gain a lot because, you know, it's a reduction of a factor of 4, right? Like you do it once and you get it all the time. And if you have to do the same with 20, you would say, well, yeah, do it with 3. The inverse question. Imagine that what I have is Grover. I have access to Grover. And I ask, I want to encode things. How many different, because you know, to encode things, you can use base 2, like bits. You can use base 4, base 10, as we do with numbers all the time, right? But in mind that I'm asking, what is the right base to encode, the number of elements to encode information, if what I have at my avail is Grover? Say, well, use 4, because then Grover will give you 1. It's like, well, OK, 4, it's fine for some things. But maybe for others, I need to actually use more, because it's difficult just to get 4. Well, then the next best is 20. Use 20, because then it's 3. Make sense? 2 is just not an integer, or very far for an integer. So 1 and 3. That doesn't make sense. So if you are tasked to build a machine that encodes information using 4 different units of information from different units of information, then if you have access to Grover, you would use the opposite. If you have to build a machine that encodes information and you want to read it out, you want to find what that information is telling you in one step with Grover, then pick 4 to encode it. And if you want to have the second best, pick 20. Does anybody recognize those numbers as something that is used in an encoding information scenario? In
DNA.
So if you want to encode information on DNA, you can do DNA with many nitrogen bases, nitrogen bases pairs, right? In fact, there are like in the lab, you can generate about 10 or so that are easy. And you can actually build DNA strands of those, right? But if you want to actually use Grover to find one of the hydrogen bases to bring it in, well, then pick 4. And do you know another one that uses 20? That's a bit more advanced. Biology question.
Some amino acids.
Is the amino acids that of all the amino acids in the world, there are many, we use 20 for encoding life only. So DNA translates information about sequences of amino acids. So you need to pick DNA bases to do pick 4. If you want to pick amino acids and you have to have enough variety, maybe pick 20. So maybe nature uses Grover to find those things. Again, it's a wild thing, but it's a coincidence, right? That it happens for two numbers that are the two search features in life that you need to do to encode information. It's falsifiable, because you can actually create artificial life with more than those. It's in principle doable. So you just need to do it or do it, strands and try to do replication with more and see if it works, if it's as efficient. And anyway, just a fun detail, just for fun. Don't put it in the same level, at the same level as everything else I've told you today. Yeah?
So if I don't know the length of an array, then Grover's is pretty bad, right? Because then I have to find the length and then do the...
No. What do you mean?
Because it seems like the...
So it's the same as saying, let me put it another way. If you don't know the length of a phone book, you cannot use it. But you never know the length of a phone book. The factory needs to know. Whoever gives you the superposition needs to know. That's all you need.
But in the classical case, if I don't know the length of a phone book, I still solve it in complexity of O(n).
Same here. O root n. You don't need to know the length. Where did you, in the inputs here, of the things that you have to do, where does the length appear?
I think it appears in like overshooting, right? In like choosing n, basically.
Ah, that's what you mean. I see. Okay, fine. Okay, you can overshoot a bit, sure. Yeah, you're right. On that, you're fine, you're correct. You can also, I guess this to be devil's advocate, you could also overshoot classically if you program the number of queries to find out, to make sure that you get 99% probability of getting it, you have to program n times. However, maybe you get it at the second or the third by chance. You could overshoot that. So you need to be aware of that. So maybe what you can have is many copies of the phone book and then measure it every time and see what it's converging towards, right? And then you could do it like that. But no, fair. Technically, you're right on that. You can overshoot, but there are techniques not to overshoot. Like, again, you can have many copies and then, you know, see the convergence towards what. And then once you've converged to something, then you're fine. Yeah?
Well, just that it gets difficult when you don't know how many things are being marked. Then you don't have a good mathematical formula when to start.
Correct. But the important thing, I guess, what I want to emphasize is that none of the steps of what you have to do depend on n. True. The fact that you have to stop eventually does depend on n. But none of the things that you need to do except for that depend on n.
So what you're saying is that practically what you would do is you would plot this graph and then see at which point this is less.
Yeah. Again, or you know the number. Huh? And if the number is much easier. Yeah. But fair enough.
You know the number in classical algorithms as well, right?
You do, because you need to program an array. Yes.
But like,
agreed. You can ask for the dimension of the array, 100%. Yeah. So that's not a big. It's not a big deal. You are right, huh? But it's not definitely not a big deal. Any questions about Grover? Yeah.
Is this realizable?
Oh yeah, 100%.
How? Like what?
Creating a superposition and creating operators unitaries that act on that. You're gonna do it in the IBM quantum computer, for example, and that is a quantum computer. That's actually being run on a quantum computer. So yeah, certainly realizable. If you have a universal quantum computer, meaning that that if it takes, say, 16 bits of qubits of input, then you can do anything on those. So in particular, you can do Hadamards, and you have these unitaries as well. So you can implement this circuit 100%. And you can write this circuit in terms of elementary unitaries as well to program a computer. So yeah, certainly. Anytime that you have the means to make a quantum computer, you have a means to do this.
I've used it to solve 3SAT with 10 qubits.
And you're going to do it actually for 4 qubits in the computer. I think is that what you have to do. Any more questions? All right. Shor is another story. Shor is fun because Shor, for a long time, it was only number 15 that was factorized using Shor in a quantum computer. But now we have 23 as well. 23 is easy. 27, I think. 20 something. I forget. It's in the tutorial is written. What was 20 what?
21.
21. OK, my bad. So it's better than 15. OK, 3.5. We become better. 7.3. Anyway. So it's much more difficult to implement. The thing is that we need big quantum computers. All right, then. Let's talk about quantum cryptography. Sorry for the fast pace of this, right? But I really want to have the last lecture to do quantum energy teleportation. That's going to be very fun, because that combines quantum information protocols with very fundamental results. Anyway, let's talk about quantum cryptography. There will be notes about this as well. Okay, so don't worry too much. So now, there are two ways of doing cryptography, right? If you want, two big categories. One, let me put it like that before you don't want to be distracted. One is we actually do cryptography, meaning like there's no way that anybody that looks at the message can decipher it other than the intended person. And the other one is like, well, no, the information is still there. Somebody could read the information out. It's just very difficult for them to do it. So you could protect a message by not letting, but definitely making it impossible to find out what you're communicating. But you could also do it by making it very difficult. Make sense? That's what I mean here. Now. We will talk about these two ways of doing things because they have the pros and cons, right? In fact, what we use nowadays for almost everything is the second category. We take advantage of problems. We take advantage that we believe that P and NP are not the same. And what we find is problems that are easy to solve, easy to check a solution, but difficult to actually solve. So problems that are easy one way, but not the other. All right? That's what we use right now. In particular, for example, we use RSA and many of the other algorithms that are based on prime number factorization are based on the idea that multiplying is and dividing is easy, but prime factoring is not easy. So if I give you a big number and I ask you, find the prime factors of that, that's going to be a tough problem. But if I give you a number and some of the prime factors, then it's much easier. It becomes suddenly much easier. Make sense? Summarizing a lot. Let's talk about secure cryptography. And in particular, the simplest protocol yet as potent as all of them. One-time pad. What is this? Well, so imagine that I have a message. That's what I want to transmit. That's the message. And I want to send somebody the message. Now, what I need to share with somebody is what I call a key. A key is a set of randomly generated numbers. Better be random, OK? Because if there are correlations in them, well, maybe somebody can guess it. Do a dictionary attack or something. And you know, if this thing is just password 1234, it's I'm going to just try until I get something that gives me a message that makes sense, right? But let's say that I have a randomly generated sequence. This is a message. This is not randomly generated. This thing is a message. Huh? It's got correlations. It's language, if you want. This thing is randomly generated. So I'm going to take advantage that if I add something random to something not random, the result is random. So now, this is the addition of the two. Agreed? Well, the short of the two. The addition mod two of the two. Make sense? So the addition of the message and the key give me an encrypted message that if some random person finds it on the street, is not going to understand it. Agreed? But if you have the key, because we together generated the key together and you have it, then you can just add again, or subtract, which is the same thing, and recover the message. Make sense, everybody? OK. So what is the problem with this? The problem is this. The problem is that, well, two problems. Number one, the key has to be as long as the message. Second, you cannot really, well, first, three problems in 1 second. We need to share the key somehow. So we need to trust that whatever means we use to exchange a key is secure. Of course, you can meet in a room and make sure nobody's listening, but that's very inconvenient. Imagine you have to do that with your bank every time that you want to make a transaction, right? That would be extremely inconvenient. You better have a secure channel to communicate the key, but how do you make sure it's secure? Well, we can encrypt it. How? You don't have a key. That makes sense? Now, you could say, also, when you need to send a new message, you need to change the key. And you could say, oh, no, I don't have to change the key. I can use, you know, I can use the same key many times. Well, that didn't work very well for the Nazis, luckily for everybody else, because the Nazis were using this kind of thing. They had the Enigma machines that were a complicated implementation of that. And they could change the keys, of course, and they did from time to time. But they also recycle keys because the messages they send are long and they cannot get together to reprogram their machines and change the key as often. And also, they were pretty stupid. They also ended all their messages with Heil Hitler. So mathematicians actually used that, the fact that the end of the messages was always Heil Hitler, to find the correlations of the key, to guess the key. That's called a Cribbin, the message, of course. The Cribbin dragging attack, right? Which is you find correlations between the views and the same key, then the correlations of the message are going to end up reflected in the encrypted message because you have something random, but it's always the same. So certainly, again, that was nice for the world because it allowed the allies to get the information. That was a big deal. Alan Turing and many others cracked the Enigma machine that were used to send communications of everything, and they started syncing. They're starting like destroying them completely, all the logistics, which is what wins wars, by the way. So mathematicians won World War II, actually, to a big extent. Anyway, so yeah, don't use one-time pad, don't reuse the key, don't end your messages the same way. Make sense? All right. Now, even if you don't use the same way all the time, you will get cracked because language, natural language has correlations. The number of times that you use a word after another, for example, the word the typically is before a noun, right? So again, there are correlations in language that can be used to crack that with a Cribbin dragging attack, OK? I'm not going to get into it much because this is not about this, but hopefully it is clear that one-time pad is secure as long as the key is used only once, it's as long as the message, and we're sure that we are securely sharing the key. Nobody got eyes on the key. Make sense? A lot of trust you need from the outside world for this to work. So instead, what we use nowadays is not that. We use, again, for example, the complexity of prime number factorization. That's what we use now. Prime number factorization is complex. So what we use is we send messages that actually contain all the information, but it's crumbled in a way that requires you to actually factorize a large prime number. And that is tough. And then you rely on the fact that people don't have the computational power. You get a key that is large enough, a prime number that is large enough, standard is now above 256 bits, but it should be more like 1024 or something like that. If that's the case, you get a number, a prime number that is as large as 2 to the 1024, do factor number, factorize that, you know? Remember the time it takes to factorize? I mean, you haven't seen it yet, but you will. The time it takes to factor, in a tutorial, the time it takes to factorize with the best algorithm we have, a prime number scales super polynomially, faster than a polynomial with the length of the prime number. So it's very, very difficult to actually do it. You need computers that are super big and operate for times that are longer than the age of the universe, and then you kind of get satisfied that it's
that. Keys are easy to generate, right?
Because the keys are very easy to generate.
Just factor.
Because what you can generate them by multiplying small numbers, whereas factoring is the difficult part. The keys are trivial to generate for a computer, but factorizing is not. Now, the problem is that, as I'm saying, short algorithm that you're going to see in the tutorials, right, actually factors in polynomial time. So if short algorithm is implemented at scale in a quantum computer, many of the algorithms, classical algorithms, are going to fall. RSA, the most famous one that we use all the time, is going to fall. Now, there's a field of research that is called post-quantum cryptography. That is not quantum cryptography, it's different. Post-quantum cryptography is classical cryptography, okay? Which is find classical algorithms that we don't know algorithms for quantum computers to crack. Just don't make it rely on prime number factorization. There are many other very complicated problems that we can use. Make sense? And some of them can be reduced and mapped to prime number factorization. A surprisingly big amount of them can be mapped to prime number factorization, but not all of them. So researching, computer scientists, right, are researching algorithms, cryptographic algorithms that are resistant to quantum computers in the sense of we expect that a quantum computer cannot solve this in a good scale. They exist, huh? And we are ready for quantum computer. Even if tomorrow somebody has a huge quantum computer and we don't have quantum cryptography yet, we would be ready. We can swap the algorithm. So it's not the end of the world. It will cause some turmoil for a while, huh? But people will adapt. Make sense? They're more difficult to implement, more expensive, but you know, they're resistant to quantum, to short algorithm, right? Quantum prime number factorization. Now, another possible solution is quantum cryptography. Now, quantum cryptography is a big family of algorithms that allow you to share information, to share a key. They're based on one-time pad, in a way, many of them. One-time pad is like, well, we need a key. Well, quantum algorithms are going to allow you to generate a secure key. That's the idea. You have you use the algorithm to remotely generate keys that you know are secure. Make sense? And then once you have the keys, if you know you share them, and only you share them, you can use them for one-time pad. That's the idea. We're going to see one. BB84 was the first actually developed. I think it's Bennett and Brassard. That's the BB of 84. There are more, right? And they typically, that comes from computer science and cryptography. They name the algorithms by name of the authors and the year. That's typical. There are more advanced ones that use entanglement, and the resources used change, but it's mainly the same principle for most of them. So let's see this one, which is simple and it's nice and it's fun. Okay. So Alice and Bob want to communicate a key through a quantum channel. So we have a quantum channel. We need a quantum channel. Imagine an optical fiber, and you send photons, and you use the polarization of the photons for it. Okay? Or an electron. You send electrons through some carbon nanotube, whatever you want. People sell those things, by the way. They are commercially done already. And they use light, typically. Polarization of light. Okay, so let's get to the protocol. So we have Alice and Bob both share a common reference frame. That's the resource they share here. You can relax that by using entanglement instead, but for this one, they have a common reference frame. Okay? Classical reference frame. Nothing fancy. We have GPS, for example, so that's enough. For the world, definitely works. And then they have two different bases, right? This is, we're talking about, for example, polarization, a two-dimensional quantum system. So it could be the polarization of light, polarization of a photon, spin of an electron, something like that. Make sense? And we have two bases. We have if you want, the plus bases, right? And then one that is rotated 45 degrees, right? The x bases. Make sense? So we have that the two bases are related, the state V and the state H, of course, are linear combinations of DNA, the useful way. There are two different bases. They're unbiased measurements. So you see, for examples, an eigenstate of that measuring these bases would give you 50-50, finding one or the other. Make sense? And we're going to use the encoding scheme to go from binary classical information to results of measurements. If you measure in the plus bases and you measure a V, that means a 1. Okay? If you measure an H, that means a 0. If you're measuring the X bases, if you measure an A, A is for antidiagonal. Okay? If you measure an A, you get a 1. If you measure a D, you get a 0. That's going to be our convention. Make sense? How to go from results of measurements to classical bits. All right, so step one. Alice generates a key. Random, key generation. After that, Alice generates a random sequence of measurement bases. So Alice generates a set of random numbers that tells her when she's going to use the plus bases or the X bases to encode. So randomly picks one or the other. And for each measurement, right, well, measurements if you want, for each preparation, right, she encodes the 0 or the 1 of its key using one basis or the other. Okay? For example, if C gets a 0, uses the plus basis. If it gets an X, uses a 1 for the random number, use the X basis. And then within that, encodes the key number by preparing and sending the polarization associated with the 0 and the 1, as we said before. Make sense? Then sends the quantum information. So the photon or the photons, right, where it's encoded. So again, Alice has a number, 10011, whatever. And then Alice generates another set of numbers, 00101, whatever. The second set of numbers tells Alice what bases to use. And then once it picked a basis, encodes the 1 or the 0 according to the basis it picked for the key. And then sends the light, sends the photon. And then Bob receives the photon. So Bob receives the photons, but before doing that, Bob generates a random sequence of measurement bases, same as Alice, a random number that decides in what basis he's going to measure randomly. And then Bob performs a measurement of the quantum channel, so the photon, right? Bob measures the photon, and it's in the basis that he got from the random number generator. Now, of course, sometimes he's going to have the wrong basis. Then the probability of finding a 1 or a 0 is going to be 50-50 if he measures the wrong basis, right? But if it's the right basis, the probability of finding the right one is 1. Make sense? So let's see. After that, Alice discloses in a public channel, not in a secure one, posts on Reddit, for example, what choice of basis he did. I did the X first, the plus second, the X, and then Bob said, oh, okay, I got it wrong half of the time. So I'm going to just discard the ones that I got wrong, and I keep the ones that I got right. I'm not going to reveal the outcome, but I'm going to keep them. And that's our key. And tells Alice that, and they keep the key. Let's illustrate it. Let's illustrate it. This is very easy, actually. Sounds more complicated when I just read the steps. So we do it. Alice generates a key. That's the key that she generates. She wants to share at least some of that key with Bob. Make sense? Then generates, this is the random basis in which he prepares things. So it's a plus, sometimes is the X, sometimes. Make sense? So she encodes now with that sequence. Instead of cares. Of course, the 1 in the plus basis is V. I encode V and I send polarization V. The 0 in the X basis is D. I send polarization D. The 1 in the plus basis, that's V. The 0 in the plus basis, that's H, and so on and so forth. So she's sending, think of it as one photon per use, per number in here. Then Bob also generates randomly and locally a sequence of bases, which is plus, plus, X, plus, X, X, plus, X, X. Of course, it's not related at all with the one that Alice picked. It's random. Half of the time is going to coincide with Alice by chance. Half of it is going to get it wrong. So then Bob measures. And then, of course, measures, right? For example, Bob, so in the first one, Bob gets a 1, obviously, right? In the second one, well, Bob could have gotten anything because he's measuring an eigenstate of a basis that's 45 degrees. It could be a 0 or a 1. That's why I don't write it here. Maybe it's a 0. Maybe it's a 1. It doesn't matter because it's the wrong basis, so it could be either. Cannot be sure. Make sense? So half of the time, he got it right. So what he does now is for example, right? Let's say that he got a 1 on this one, a 1 on this one, a 0 on this one, a 0 on this one, 1 on this one. Sometimes he actually got the right one, but it's by chance. See what I mean? Sometimes he got it wrong. Sometimes he got it right, but it's just because by chance. Make sense? So what they do now is they communicate, and Alice says, Bob, I used plus x plus plus x plus plus x plus x. And Bob said, okay, so we're going to discard the second, the third, the 4, 5, 6, the 6, the 9th, and so on. You know what I mean? And then they know each other. Say, fine. Alice says, fine. So Alice discards the numbers that Bob told her that he didn't guess the right bases. And they keep those numbers. And nobody has found out those numbers so far. Make sense? That's how they share the key. So they keep about half of the original as the key. Now, there's an issue with this, right? Because the whole point of this is that the problem, how can you be sure that nobody intercepted that? So imagine now that we have an eavesdropper. We have an adversary that can do anything, can intercept both. The classical channel is public, right? They talk in public. I'm telling you, you post it on Reddit. But also, imagine that one actually intercepts the quantum channel. So typically, if it's a classical thing, Eve gets a 1, Eve writes down a 1, and sends a 1 back to Alice, right? So either snoops, looks at it, or intercepts it and sends another. It's called a man-in-the-middle attack. There's somebody in the middle of the channel, reading everything that's going through. It's one of the most common ways that people hack computers using Wi-Fi. They get in between the router and the computer, and they just look at all the information that's going through. Make sense? In mind that that happens. Here is not the hacking of a classical channel, it's the hacking of a quantum channel. And that's what makes it so solid. Let's see what happens in that case. Let's do an attack scenario. So far it's the same as before, right? But now in the middle, we have, between Alice and Bob, the optical fiber they're using, we have Eve. And Eve intercepts the optical fiber. And Eve, what Eve's going to do is going to measure and write down what she gets and sends the same thing to Bob. The whole point, though, is that because this is a quantum mechanical system, if you actually measure it and obtain the information, you're actually modifying the system. So let's see what happens.
She sends the same or she generates a new?
It could be either. Same thing. Even if it's the same system, if he gets information, it's a projective measurement. If it's a new one, it creates a new, it's the same effect as a projective measurement, creating a new one with the same polarization. All right, so let's say that Eve, of course, doesn't know the basis yet in the middle of sending. So she has to choose. That's the thing. Eve has a choice now. What basis do I measure? She doesn't know because Alice has not revealed and the photons are going. So she better do something. So she's going to randomly generate a sequence of bases to measure, same as Bob. That's the best she can do. So she's like, well, half of the time I'll get it right. Make sense? All right. So imagine that Eve measures D, D, V, A, V, D, H. Now, the problem here is that, but sometimes she actually got the wrong basis. In red here is the time that she got the wrong basis. Make sense? Now, of course, Eve measures that, and Eve sends that. Either by I measure, so I projected and I got that, those states, or I generated a new one in those states. Same thing. So Eve sends down the channel those states. And then Bob, with the same choice as before, says, okay, plus, plus, x, x, plus, let's measure now. Make sense? So we are in the same scenario. Oops. We are in the same scenario. And then Alice and Bob, so instead of writing 1 and 0, I just write what they measure, and you have to remember which one it is. It doesn't matter. It has to be the same as Alice, though. Now, Alice and Bob now talk in the public channel. Eve is also listening to the public channel and to the classical channel, right? And Alice says, okay, I use plus x plus plus x plus plus x plus. And then Bob said, okay, same as before. You know, okay, let's keep the first one, the fourth one, and so on. So they discard the ones that they didn't have the same basis on. Agreed? Now, the problem now, the issue now is that, well, you see, in this one, I should get V, but I got H. In this one, I should get V, but I got H. In this one, I should get V, but I got H. So there are times that Bob maybe has it right or has it wrong, but it's random, where he should be deterministic instead of random. See what I mean? The probability of having this one right for Bob is 50-50. But they talked, Alice and Bob, and they agreed that it has to be 100%. But instead it's 50-50 because of the action of if. Agreed? Now, what they do now is same as before said, which they have this scenario. You see, the key that they share, right, is not the same. It's not the same. It's not the same. Look, in this one it coincides, but by chance. Agreed? But there are cases that it doesn't coincide. So what Alice and Bob say is, okay, now let's share publicly half of the key. The key is long, let's check half. My key is 0, 1. Whoa, stop. That's not the key we have. Somebody's listening, somebody's snooping. We detected. The channel is not secure. Stop communication. Make sense? So by taking half of the key, for example, you can make sure, or a fraction of the key, you can make sure that nobody tampered with the channel, with the quantum channel. Now, of course, this is not deterministic. This is probabilistic. You can have a very lucky if that actually got the right results by chance. But what's the probability of that working? Well, there's a probability 1/2 for if to guess the right basis to begin with. If if gets the right basis, in the cases that matter, Bob is not going to notice. There's also a probability 1/2 of getting the right answer by chance when C chose the wrong basis. Agreed? So in all those cases, in these two cases, Alice and Bob would not notice. What's the probability of that happening? Well, it's 1/2 times 1. 1/2, this is the second layer probability. 1/2 times 1, so 1/2 for in the case that C chose the right basis. And then 1/2 times 1/2 in the case that C chose the wrong basis. So if you add them together, it's 3/4. The probability of, with for one bit of exchange, the probability of it being detected is 3/4. Not being detected is 3/4, 75%. Agreed? But of course, if you're sending n qubits, the probability is 3/4 per qubit of being undetected. That's exponentially going to 0. It has to illustrate a bit. For 10 qubits, it's 0.056. But the keys are typically way more. Say that I have 1,000, like 1,024. For 100 even, not even. For 100 qubits, the probability is this, that is undetected. So if you have a key that's decently large, the probability that an eavesdropper can actually tamper with your system and you don't detect it is almost 0. Now, of course, there are modifications of this protocol. And in the notes, I'll have some references, hopefully, where you allow for, well, but sometimes it's an experimental mistake. You know, that happens. Sometimes you measure the wrong thing because of an experimental error. Those things are still secure. They are still secure. You can correct for that by increasing the key. So this is a very robust method, BBA84. In fact, this is a commercial method. People sell it. But hopefully that illustrates, running out of time, but hopefully that illustrates the protocol. Any questions about it? So the key point in this protocol is not that you can make sure that you and the other person are seeing the key and there's nobody in the middle. No, it's that if there's somebody in the middle, if somebody looks, it's going to alter the state. If they have to extract enough information to make it work, they're going to have to alter the state in a way that we can detect and then scrap it. Make sense? And then examine the optical fiber. Somebody is cutting into our optical fiber. That makes sense? All right. Any questions? Okay. So apologies for the pace of this lecture. It's two things very fast, and they're pretty cool in their own right, and there's much to say about them. I encourage you for Monday is at 10, right? Do we have a room already?
Time room.
Awesome. So on Monday, we're going to see each other here at 10 as well, if you want. Obviously voluntary. But what I would ask from you is that you write questions, at least one per person. That would be ideal. If more, the better. okay? And we can expand on these things a little bit. I can tell you more things about this thing.
We also have some questions in the feedback form.
Perfect. We can check those questions and go over them in those times as well. I hope you like, did you like, you should like it. I mean, again, what I mean by that is that if you don't like it, not liking it is my fault because they're super cool. These things are super cool. These are ways of doing things that classically are a pain to do. And because we use the principles of quantum mechanics, we can actually do them much safer and much better. So hopefully this illustrates, and together with short algorithm that you'll see in two tutorials, you'll see the power of applying quantum computing and quantum cryptography instead of over the classical counterparts. All right, so tomorrow, generalized tomorrow, that's Wednesday, we see quantum energy teleportation. Have you heard about it before? Good. Let me just give you a little teaser. Quantum energy teleportation is about using consuming entanglement in order to send energy from A to B without any energy traveling from A to B. And that is super cool for many reasons. With thermodynamics, we'll talk about it because thermodynamically super cool. But even think quantum field theory. Imagine that you have a quantum field, right? And you have the vacuum state of the quantum field. So as close to nothing as it can be. Think the electromagnetic field. The vacuum state of a quantum field contains entanglement. Do you know that? I mean, it's a trendy thing. You know that there's entanglement in the ground state of a field theory. Well, you can use that entanglement to do QET. And if you do it right, you're doing an operation. If the information from A goes to B, and B uses that information to extract energy without energy traveling, the stress energy density, if it's zero, original, because it's a vacuum, the renormalized stress energy density is zero. Now that stress energy density is going to have to be bumping negative because B is extracting energy from it. And if you have a negative bump of stress energy density, you know what happens? Oh, you can have exotic reactions of space-time. You can have things like anti-gravity and warp drives and wormholes in the extreme, right? So we can discuss a little bit the implications on fundamental results of quantum teleportation, both thermodynamically and quantum field theoretical as well. And it's a nice protocol that mixes quantum information with QFT and relativity. And those are things that you all see in your PSI courses. So I think it's going to be nice to see that protocol. And also, explaining for qubits is as easy as this. You see that quantum algorithms, not sure though. But the quantum algorithms we've seen are very actually simple to go over, right? It's going to be as simple for quantum teleportation. All right, see you Wednesday.